when my mother died trying to protect you," she said with a seething intensity I'd never seen before. "That's exactly why you should help me," I said, trying to keep my voice strong. "We both know that I'm not the person to lead the Milago against the Bedouin, but Uncle Press is. I want to rescue him because he's my uncle, and if you care about the Milago as much as you say you do, then you should want to rescue him because these people need him." Lore didn't move right away. I thought I saw something in her eyes. Was it a moment of doubt? She backed away from me and picked up her wooden weapon from the floor of the cavern. "There is a meeting," she said coldly. "I will allow you to come." A meeting? Cool. I didn't know what it was about, but at least she had thought enough to include me. That was a start. She stepped forward and pointed the end of her weapon at me threateningly. "I will not protect you, Pendragon," she said. "If you come with me, you are on your own." With that sweet little promise delivered, she walked off. I wasn't sure what to do until she turned back over her shoulder and barked, "Come, now!" I wasn't sure where we were going either, but I was willing to follow her and find out. She led me back up the ladders to the surface. Night had fallen, and the stars made it bright enough to see clearly. Lore glanced around quickly, probably looking for any knights that might still be hanging around looking for us. Good idea. I looked around too, but all was quiet. I followed her back into the Milago village and straight to the hut where I first woke up. When we ducked inside, I saw that I was right about this being a hospital. Sort of. Two of the wooden benches now had occupants. But these two weren't here to get well. It was Osa and the miner who was killed at the mine shaft. This is where they were keeping the bodies until doing whatever they were going to do with them. I suppose I should have been creeped out, but I wasn't. There were two other people there as well, only these two were alive and well. It was Alder, the knight who Lore said was the traveler from Dendoron, and Relan, the chief miner. They were sitting cross-legged in front of a fire that was burning in the hearth. Lore walked right over and sat down as well. I figured this was the meeting Lore had invited me to, so I sat down across from Lore. Relan started the meeting by saying,
"I am sorry about your mother, Lore. She was a good person. I speak for all the Milago when I say how grateful we are to you and your people for coming here to help us. It saddens me that it had to end this way."
Lore was quick to respond and said, "I thank you for your sympathy, but my mother's death does not end things. We will still lead the Milago to their freedom." Relan looked nervous. Suddenly there was tension in the air. I felt it, and Lore felt it. I'm not sure what Alder felt, because I didn't know him well enough.
"No,"
Relan said with finality.
"It is over. There will be no fighting."
With that declaration, he got up to leave. But Lore jumped up and stopped him. Relan's comment had taken her by surprise.
"How can you say that, Relan?" she asked. "If the Milago do not break free of the Bedouin, you will all die."
"And if we fight them, we will die much sooner," said Relan. "My people are not warriors. You know that, Alder."
He looked to Alder, who dropped his head. Relan then looked back to Lore and said,
"And you know that too, Lore. We would have no chance in a fight with the Bedouin knights. We would be slaughtered."
Lore didn't give up.
"Remember what Press said? You may not be warriors, but you are strong. He said the Bedouin do not have the character to resist if the Milago stand up for themselves. He said—"
"Press is gone," shouted Relan. "And now Osa is gone as well. Who is left to lead us in this mad quest? You? Him?"
He said this while pointing at me.
"You are children. Your motives are noble, but it is time to end these foolish dreams."
With that, he turned and stormed out of the hut. The meeting was over. I could tell that Lore wanted to go after him, but she didn't. She may have been a warrior, but she didn't have the words to change his mind.
"He is wrong," said Alder softly. "The Bedouin are not as strong as Relan thinks."
Lore walked slowly toward the body of her mother. She looked down at the fallen woman, then touched her arm as if trying to gain strength from her.
She took the wooden zashaza she had been carving and placed it in her mother's lifeless hand. And this was tearing my heart out. I can only imagine how Lore felt.
"He is lying," she said with finality.
Alder looked up quickly. This surprised him as much as it had me.
"Say what?"
was all I could come back with.
"Rillan has wanted to fight the Bedouin all of his life," she explained. "His anger and hatred are far greater than his fear. I do not believe that he has changed his way of thinking so quickly."
Alder stood up. He looked as confused as I felt.
"Then why did he say there would be no fight?" he asked.
Lore kept her eyes on her mother and answered,
"I do not know, but something has changed, something he has not told us about. Maybe he does not trust us because we are so young."
I thought back to the other two times I had seen Rowan. The first was at the transfer ceremony. Though I was far away, I felt his hatred for the Bedouin. The other time was in the mines after the explosion. After he was rescued, he had that strange laugh that felt so out of place. Lore was right. Something odd was happening.
"He trusted your mother, didn't he?" I asked.
"Of course," came her quick reply.
"Then he would have told her if things had changed, and she would have told you, right?" I asked.
"Are you saying that I am wrong?"
she asked.
"No," I answered quickly. "I'm saying that if you're right, then something strange is going on, and the fact that he didn't tell your mother about it makes me kind of nervous."
We all let this hang in the air for a while. Finally, Alder said,
"So what do we do?"
I knew the answer to that. So did Lore, but I wanted to say it first.
"We rescue Uncle Press," I announced. "We gotta get him back here."
I shot a look at Lore. She didn't have to say a word. I knew what she was thinking. Rescuing Uncle Press was exactly what we needed to do, and she had decided to help me. She then looked to Alder and said,
"This will be a difficult fight, Alder. You will have to reveal to them that you are a traveler."
Alder stood up proudly and said,
"I knew this day would come. I am ready."
"Whoa, whoa," I said, while stepping between them. "Who said anything about a fight?"
Lore scoffed and said,
"If you think we can get into the Bedouin fortress, find Press, release him, and get out without a fight, you are not only a coward, you are a fool."
Lore's macho act was starting to get old, but I didn't want to make her angry by telling her so. I had to stand up to her or she'd walk all over me.
"Yeah,"
I said, trying to match her bravura.
"The goal here is to get Uncle Press out, and if you think the three of us have any chance of doing that by fighting Kagan's knights, then maybe you're the fool."
Lore didn't have a comeback. Alder put the icing on the cake for me by saying,
"He is right, Lore. If we charge in fighting, we will be killed before we find Press."
This bothered Lore. It was obvious that her first reaction to problem-solving was to come out swinging. But she wasn't an idiot, and she was beginning to realize that her way might not have been the best way in this case.
"Then what do we do?" she asked. "Ask Kagan politely to release Press? Maybe if we said please, it would happen."
Whoa, the musclehead was capable of sarcasm.
Maybe she had more going on than I gave her credit for.
"The only chance we have is to sneak in there without them knowing," I said. "The longer we can stay invisible, the better chance we have of getting Uncle Press out." Alder was getting excited. He said,
"Yes, I know a way to get in, and I know every corridor of that fortress. There are passageways and tunnels that are rarely used."
Lore didn't like being told she was wrong, especially by someone she didn't respect, which was me. But I think she was smart enough to know that my way made more sense. She said,
"And do you have a plan for what to do after Alder gets us into the palace?"
The fact is, I did. Sort of. It wasn't really a plan as much as it was a bunch of ideas. Unfortunately, all my ideas needed things that didn't exist here on Denduron. I needed a bunch of stuff from back home.
"If I got a message to my friends back home," I asked, "is there a way for them to send me something from there?"
Lore stepped away from me. She knew the answer, but I think she was reluctant to tell me. I was still pretty new to this whole traveler thing. Maybe she wasn't sure she could trust me with all the secrets yet.
But Alder didn't have the same concerns.
"Of course there is," he said innocently. "You can flume back to your territory and get whatever you want."
I was beginning to like this guy. Could it be as simple as that? All I had to do was go back to the flume and I could get home? Cool! But there was still the tricky issue of having to climb back to the top of that mountain to get to the gate. There's no way I could do that in time to get home, then get back here to rescue Uncle Press before he was executed. Besides, I'd probably get eaten by those quigs anyway. "That's no good," I said. "Is there another way?"
"You do not need to go to the mountain," said Lore. "There is another gate in the mines that is not guarded by quigs."
Oh, yeah! This was getting better by the second! And maybe best of all, by Lore giving me that piece of information, she was allowing herself to trust me. Maybe we could work together after all. Now that I was certain I could get home, my mind started to calculate all of the things I could get that would help us sneak into the fortress. The thing that was so cool is that the people of Denderon knew nothing about life at home. They would be blown away by something as simple as a flashlight. Man, talk about power! I wasn't exactly sure how it was going to work, but I was beginning to think that we might really have a chance of getting Uncle Press out of there. Lore took me back down to the mine. It was an uneasy truce that we had going. We both knew we needed each other, but neither of us was too happy about it. The first thing I did was go back to the small cell-like room where Lore made me wait before and finish my journal. I also wrote out the list of items and the instructions that I sent to you. Once they were ready, I rolled them up and did exactly what Osa had done when she sent you my first journal. I took off the ring, put it on the ground, touched the gray stone, and said, "Earth!" But nothing happened. I tried again. Nothing. I was suddenly hit with a terrible thought. Osa told me that the power only worked for travelers. What if I wasn't really a traveler? I was doing exactly what she did, but the ring didn't work. Maybe I wasn't a traveler after all. Lore had been watching from the doorway. Before my panic got any worse, she said,
"You are not from Earth. You are from Second Earth."
Oh, right. That's what Osa said. Second Earth. Did that mean there was a First Earth? I made a mental note to ask that question later. There were more important duties at hand. I touched the stone and said, "Second Earth." Sure enough, that was the ticket. The stone began to glow, the ring grew, the musical notes played, and I dropped the journal with my list into its center. It disappeared and all returned to normal. Cool! But then I was hit with another thought. "Lore," I asked, "how will I know when to flume back to Earth, Second Earth? It could take a long time for my friends to get the stuff together." Lore gave me the straightest answer I'd had since my arrival. And she seemed unsure of herself, like it didn't make sense to her either.
"I do not fully understand how," she began. "But when travelers fly through the flumes, they will always arrive when they need to arrive."
It was then that I realized that Lore didn't know much more about being a traveler than I did. Sure, she put on this tough front, but I think she was still trying to get her mind around the concept.
"My mother began to explain it to me," she added. "She said the flumes travel through time as well as through space, but why a traveler always arrives at the time they need to arrive was not made clear to me."
"So you're telling me that when I flume to Earth..."
"Second Earth," she corrected.
"Yeah, whatever. When I flume to Second Earth, I'll arrive at the same time that my friends arrive at the other end?"
"Yes."
"Does that work both ways, forward and back?" I asked.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, if I left right now, would my friends be waiting for me already, even though I just sent the list a minute ago?"
"I think so,"
she answered. "Then let's go." Lore led me back into the large cavern and then into a tunnel on the far side. This was an ancient tunnel, more so than the others. There were some loose rocks scattered over the Orcar tracks, which told me there hadn't been any miners through here in a long time. The walls also looked to be a bit rougher than the others, as if they hadn't quite perfected their digging techniques when this tunnel was gouged out of the earth. We had walked for quite a while when I asked, "How do you know we're going the right way?" Lore answered by raising up her hand. She was wearing a ring that was identical to mine. I couldn't believe I hadn't noticed it before. I guess when you're in the Traveler Club, everybody gets the special ring. But the thing was, the gray stone was letting off a very slight glow.
"My mother showed me this gate a few days ago," she explained. "She also showed me how to tell if a gate is nearby. The stone will tell you."
Sure enough, I looked at my own ring and saw that the gray stone was starting to glow. Then, as we rounded one more bend, I saw it. Embedded in the rock was a wooden door. Several yards farther down the tunnel was another opening. There was a pile of stones in front of that, as if it had just recently been dug out. Beyond this opening was an old ore car on the tracks. The thing probably hadn't been moved in decades.
"How do you know it's this tunnel and not that one?" I asked.
Lore pointed to the wooden door. There was a star symbol carved in it, just like the door in the subway back in the Bronx. We walked inside, and I saw the familiar tunnel that led to nowhere and everywhere. I took a few steps toward it and then turned back to Lore.
"What do I do?" I asked. "I think you know," she answered.
Yeah, I did. I walked a few steps farther into the mouth of the tunnel when Lore called to me.
"Pendragon?"
I turned back and she said,
"Your uncle is a good man. I want to rescue him too." I thought that was pretty cool. I nodded to her, then turned to face the darkness and said,
"Second Earth!" You know what happened next.
Journal number 3. Continued. Denduron.
I didn't want to leave you guys. When I took the flume back to that subway station, my thoughts were all about Uncle Press and the mission ahead. But once I got there and saw you both, I remembered how much I missed my real life. The small time I had spent on Denduron put my head in an entirely different place, but when I saw you two, I suddenly felt like I had never left home. There was a moment where the idea of stepping into that flume and jumping back to Denduron was impossible. You were right, Courtney. It would have been easy. All I had to do was walk away. But then I remembered Uncle Press, and I knew what I had to do. I had to come back. Maybe it would have been better if I had stayed with you because I've made things worse than they were. Good intentions aren't always enough. You have to be smart, and sometimes I think that I'm not that smart. I'll tell you what happened, and you be the judge. When I took the flume back to Denduron, I was greeted by Lore. The first thing she said was,
"I was not sure if you would return."
I got all indignant and said, "Hey, give me a little credit, would you?" Of course, she was absolutely right. I almost stayed on Second Earth. But I didn't want her to know that. I wanted her to think that I was confident in our mission. She said,
"We are both tired. We must get some sleep before we begin."
"Do we have enough time?" I asked. I knew that Uncle Press was to be executed at the Equinox, whatever that was. It could have been in 10 minutes for all I knew.
"The Equinox is at midday tomorrow," she explained. "When the three suns are one in the sky, we have enough time for a short rest."
Now I understood. The equinox was noon. Lore and I walked back to the small room in the mine. She didn't ask me about what was in the backpack, and I wasn't about to start explaining. That would come later. But there was one item I wanted, so I took it out. It was my digital watch. I had no idea what time it was, but if we were going to sleep, I didn't want to end up sacking out for 10 hours and waking up too late. I set the alarm to go off in 2 hours. That's just a long nap, and my tank was empty. Still, a few hours of sleep was better than nothing. Lore watched me curiously as I set the watch alarm. She even jumped back with surprise when it beeped. I assumed they didn't have watches where she came from. It made me feel like I had one up on her for a change. But more important, her surprise at the beep meant my guess was right. To the people of Denduron, the simple things I could pull out of this pack would seem like huge magic. Throwing someone off balance, even for a short time, might mean the difference between success and failure.
or between life and death.
When I dug the watch out of my pack, I also found the extra surprise you put in there, Mark. Ah, you are the best. You know how much I love Milky Ways, and the one you stuck in that pack was the most delicious treat in the history of treats. Thanks. I even offered a piece to Lore. I thought that was pretty nice of me, since I didn't have much hope of finding another Milky Way around these parts. She took the bite-sized piece, popped it cautiously into her mouth, and instantly spit it out. What a waste! I guess they don't have candy bars on her territory either. Next time you wish to feed me poison, warn me first, she demanded. What are you talking about? Where I come from, this is a major treat, I said, still laughing. Then you come from a strange place, Pendragon, she said, while taking a swig of water to wash the taste out of her mouth. It was like I had given her a Brussels sprout or something. This was the first time Lore and I weren't totally tense around each other. We were like two normal people doing normal things. Believe me, it wasn't like we were suddenly buds or anything, but it gave me the courage to ask her a question. What else did your mother tell you about being a traveler? I asked. I figured the more information I had, the better chance I had of getting out of here alive. Lore didn't answer, and busied herself arranging the animal pelts on her side of the cell floor. I knew she heard me, so I didn't ask again. I had just about given up on her when she said, "You may not like what I have to say." Oh, great. More good news. If it's important, I said, I should hear it whether I like it or not. Lore sat down on the pelts and leaned her back against the wall. In spite of what I had just said, I wasn't so sure I wanted to hear this, but I had to. "I have only known for a short time that I am a traveler," she began. "I do not know much more than you do, but there is something my mother told me that is important, maybe more important than saving Press and helping the Milago." This sounded big. She had my full attention. "I know you want to know why we are travelers, but I do not know. That is the truth. My mother said that I would understand some day, but for now it was not important. What she did tell me, though, is that we must understand our mission."
"Mission? You mean there's more to this than helping the Milago?" I asked.
"Yes," she said. "My mother explained that there are many territories, and they are all about to reach an important time. A turning point, she called it. It is a time when the outcome will either send the territory toward peace and prosperity, or plunge its people into chaos and destruction."
"So, the battle between the Milago and the Bedouin is some kind of turning point for all of Denderon?" I asked.
"That is what my mother said," she continued. "If the Milago break free of the Bedouin, then Denderon will continue to exist in peace. But if the Bedouin triumph, it could be a disaster that will destroy the entire territory."
That was huge.
This struggle wasn't just about helping these poor miners. It was about saving the whole territory.
"How did she know all this?" I asked. "That's like predicting the future."
Lore shrugged and said, "It is part of being a traveler. Some day we will understand this, but for now, we must know that the traveler's mission is to go to the territories that are about to reach their turning point and do all we can to help guide events in the right direction. That is why my mother was here. That is why Press is here. That is why you and I are here."
This was all a little cosmic for me. I thought I was finally getting my mind around how things worked, but I was only scratching the surface.
"Then who is Saint Dane?" I asked. "Saint Dane is a traveler like us," she said. "But he has been working against us. He wants the territories to turn the wrong way and create pandemonium."
"But why?"
"When we find that answer, we will know all there is to know," she said. "Right now, I do not have those answers. Now go to sleep."
"Yeah, right. Sleep. She just revealed that we have the future of Denderon in our hands, not to mention other territories that might be headed for trouble, and I was supposed to nod off to Dreamland? And to make things just a little bit more interesting, there was a killer out there trying to stop us. I saw what this St. Dane dude was capable of. Sweet dreams, Bobby boy. I was on the verge of a major brain hemorrhage and had to try and calm down. I told myself that none of this had anything to do with me. I had one goal and one goal only, to rescue Uncle Press. After that, I was out of here. If Uncle Press wanted to stay and try to change the course of history, that was his choice. But for me, I was catching the next flume home. This gave me a little comfort, and I tried to get some sleep. But before I put my head down, I asked, "Is that it? Is there anything else you're not telling me?" Lore didn't even open her eyes. She was nearly asleep. But she managed to say,
"That is all I know, Pendragon. Is that not enough?"
Oh, yeah. That was plenty. It was time for lights out. I thought I would have trouble knocking off, but the truth was I was so exhausted, I didn't even remember my head hitting the fur. That was great. Except that it felt like I had just closed my eyes when my watch alarm went off. 2 hours felt more like 2 seconds. Man, did I go out hard. I had one of those weird waking up moments and didn't know where I was. It seemed like I was in my bed at home, and my first thought was, I gotta walk Marley. But in no time, the reality of my situation came hurtling back. I sat up and tried to clear my head. Lore wasn't there. After a stretch and a yawn, I went to my pack to do inventory and saw that the clips were undone. Somebody had been going through my pack. I quickly threw it open and did a quick scan. It looked like everything was still there, though it was definitely rummaged through. I was pissed. I clipped the pack shut and went looking for Lore. I walked back into the now familiar main cavern of the mine. It was business as usual out there. These poor guys never stopped. I briefly wondered what had happened with the latest transfer ceremony and if they had mined enough glaze to balance with the woman Malos had chosen. I hoped so, but there was nothing I could do about that. I needed to find Lore and get the rescue show on the road. I scanned the cavern and something caught my eye. Walking out of a tunnel to my left was Relan. He walked along quickly while speaking with another one of the miners. The weird thing was, these guys actually looked happy. Relan slapped the guy on the back like they had just shared some joke, and the guy took off running someplace. Now, these guys had nothing to be happy about. The last time I spoke with Relan, he had pretty much condemned his entire tribe to a slow death by refusing to stand up against Kagan. Why was he happy all of a sudden? When he got farther away, I went to take a look down the tunnel they had just come from. I entered to find that it was another abandoned avenue. The Orkar railroad tracks were old and rotten. This must have been one of the first tunnels they dug off the main cavern. I wondered how long ago that was. Years? Decades? Centuries? I also wondered why Relan and the other miner were down here. I found my answer a few yards in. As with many of the other tunnels, there was a chamber dug out of the rock off to the side. But unlike the cell where I had just slept, this one had a wooden door to it. I took a quick look around to see if I was being watched, then opened the door and went inside. It was a room about twice the size of the one I had just slept in, and this one was packed full of equipment. At first I thought this was where they kept their mining tools, but on closer inspection, I saw the truth. This wasn't digging equipment. This was an armory loaded with weapons. There were hundreds of spears, like the ones Uncle Press had lashed to the side of the sled we rode from the top of the mountain. I was surprised to see their sharp metal tips gleaming in the light. The Malaga weren't allowed to use metal tools except in the mines, but I was sure they weren't allowed to make weapons either. One side of the room was full of these spears. Below them were stacks and stacks of arrows. There must have been thousands. Across from them were the bows for the arrows. Probably 100 in all. This looked to be a pretty formidable arsenal. Then I saw something that didn't quite make sense. There were large baskets placed along the back wall. I recognized them as the baskets they used to bring the glaze to the surface. These baskets were full, but not with glaze. I walked over to them and picked up one of the items inside. It was a small, sturdy stick, about 6 inches long. Attached to one end were two thin leather straps about 18 inches long. At the other end of the strap, a leather pouch the size of a baseball card was attached. I looked at the strange contraption, trying to figure out what it could be. And then I got it. It was a slingshot. An old-fashioned slingshot. These guys didn't have rubber, so it wasn't the kind that you could stretch back and snap to propel stones. With this thing, you had to hold the wooden stick and kind of fling the stone. There must have been a couple of hundred of these babies in the baskets. As I stood there holding the slingshot, I was struck with a sad thought. Relan was right. The Milago were not prepared to do battle with Kagan's knights. These slingshots were pitiful. Sure, we all knew the story about David slaying Goliath, but that was just a story. How did these guys think they could stand a chance against trained killer knights in armor by using these toys? The spears looked a little more dangerous. The arrows did too, but did the Milago even know how to use them? Suddenly, Relan's concern seemed very real to me. If they tried to fight the Bedouin, they'd be slaughtered. I was just about to drop the slingshot back in its basket when somebody reached out and grabbed it from my hand. I turned in surprise to see Figgis. He danced away from me, swinging the slingshot over his head.
"Changed your mind, have you?" he chirped. "Ready to make a trade?"
"I don't want anything from you," I said as strongly as I could.
"No? I have many things you may need,"
he said with a toothless smile.
"How about this?"
He took something from his waist pouch and held it up to me. It was a red Swiss Army knife.
"That's mine," I shouted, and grabbed it away from him. "You went through my pack. What else did you take?"
The mystery of why my pack was worked over had been solved. Figgis didn't put up a fight for it. He just cackled out a wheezy laugh.
"I know what you really need," he said slyly. I know.
"What do I need?" I asked, losing patience.
"You need tack,"
he announced.
"I am the one, the only one who can get it for you."
Tack. There was that word again. "What is tack?" I asked. Figgis laughed again and reached into his waist pouch.
"Tack is the answer,"
he said reverently.
"Tack is the hope."
Whatever tack was, it couldn't be very big because it fit in his pouch. He was just about to pull it out when Relan walked in.
"Figgis!"
he shouted. Figgis instantly pulled his hand out of the pouch, empty. He looked incredibly guilty.
"You should not have brought him here, old man,"
Relan chastised. Figgis cowered and ran out of the room like a guilty puppy. Whatever tack was, it was clear he did not want Relan to know that he was trying to sell me some.
"I am sorry you saw this room,"
he said, sounding tired.
"I do not want you to think we still have hope of fighting the Bedouin. These weapons will soon be destroyed."
Something wasn't right. Relan wasn't telling me the whole truth. I figured, since he wasn't being totally upfront with me, then I should be careful about what I said to him. So I didn't mention the tack thing that Figgis was trying to sell me. "I guess you gotta do what you gotta do," was all I could think of saying. I didn't like being there, especially since there was something going on that I wasn't clear on. The best thing for me to do then was leave. So I walked past Relan and out the door. He didn't say another word to me. Once away from there, my thoughts went back to the problem at hand, which was Uncle Press. So I ran back to the cell where my gear was. When I stepped inside that room, I saw that Lore and Alder were there, and they were going through my stuff.
They had it spread out all over the floor. Wasn't there any such thing as privacy around here? Hey! I shouted. Alder jumped back, embarrassed. But Lore kept right on rummaging. I am looking for the weapons you brought back, she said, without a hint of apology. I see no weapons here. She said this while shaking one of the yellow walkie-talkies you sent. I grabbed it from her and said, I didn't get any weapons. I wouldn't even know how to use a weapon. Then this is all useless, she spat out. That's what you think, I said, and handed her back the walkie-talkie. I then found the other walkie-talkie and stepped to the far side of the room. I put it up to my mouth, hit the send button, and said,
Boo!
Both Lore and Alder jumped in surprise. Lore threw the walkie-talkie away like it was hot. Alder caught it, and then he threw it too. Man, how excellent was that? It was the exact reaction I was hoping for.
What is this magic?
Asked Alder with wide eyes. It isn't magic, I said. You gotta understand, my territory is way more advanced than here. Things like this are pretty common where I come from. It's not magic, it's science. I picked up the small CD boombox you sent and hit play. Instantly, the first track started to play. It was a headbanger rock song with thrashing guitars that sent Lore and Alder into a panic. They covered their ears and ran to the far side of the room like frightened rabbits. It was awesome. I didn't want to prolong their agony, so I turned the music off quickly. The two sat there staring at me with wide, frightened eyes. Still think we need weapons? I asked with a sly smile. Then I saw something that totally blew me away. Lore looked to me and, believe it or not, she smiled. I like this science, she said.
Me too,
added Alder. So far, so good. Their reactions gave me hope that my ideas might work. The trick was to use this stuff the right way, and the time to do that was coming fast. I took a quick inventory and saw that you were able to get everything, except for the flashlight. You guys are amazing. I was a little surprised to see that none of the stuff was mine, though. I didn't mean for you to go out and get new stuff or to send your own, Mark. But after I thought about it, I realized that it would have been hard for you to go to my house and get my stuff. My parents would have asked questions, and that would have been tricky. So as soon as I can, I'll repay you for everything. I gave one of the walkie-talkies to Lore and showed her how to use it. If we got split up, these would be crucial. The rest of the equipment I put back in the pack. Alder then added something that was a little surprising. He gave us each clothes that the Bedouin wear inside the palace. They were simple pants and jackets with long sleeves. The pants had pockets and were tied with a drawstring. The jackets closed with button-like pieces of wood. They were light, almost pastel colors of green and blue. But the thing that really jumped out at me was that they were soft. The material was some kind of cotton, and they were really comfortable. Even the leather shoes were comfortable. If I didn't know better, I'd guess that the Bedouin did their shopping at the Gap. It really struck me how the Milago lived their lives wearing rough, smelly caveman skins while the Bedouin wore these coolio, comfortable clothes that were like pajamas. Lore didn't want to wear them. She wanted Alder to get us armor from the knights. But Alder explained that the knights were not allowed to wear their armor in the palace. If we were seen inside wearing armor, the Bedouin would instantly take notice, and we'd be lost. Wearing the clothes he gave us was our best chance of blending in. Lore didn't like it, but she couldn't argue with the logic, so we quickly dressed in the Bedouin outfits. Alder also had something else of value. A map of the palace. It was crude and drawn roughly on some parchment paper, but it was good enough. It didn't show everything, but it had the key areas we needed to worry about. The cell area where Uncle Press was being held, and the guard quarters where the knights stayed. Everything seemed in place except for one small detail. Maybe the most important detail of all. This is all good, I said. But how are we going to get in?
There is a way, Alder said. The Bedouin do not know of it, and very few of the Milago are aware. My brother showed it to me the day before he died.
Now there was some new information.
Alder had a brother who died. I wanted to know what that was all about, but now was not the time for chit-chat.
"Well, then let's go," I said.
I put on the pack and followed the others out of the cell. Rather than turn for the main mine shaft to climb to the surface, Alder led us to one of the ore cars.
"No sense in all of us walking," said Alder. "Jump in."
Wherever we were going, it was underground. Lore and I climbed into the ore car, and Alder started to push. We headed down the track of yet another tunnel off the main cavern. As we passed some miners, they barely took notice of us. These poor guys were like the living dead. Alder was a pretty strong guy, and he pushed us along with ease. Luckily, the tunnel was flat, so maybe it wasn't all that hard anyway. We traveled for a long time and went pretty deep into the mine. After a while, it got totally dark, but it wasn't like we had to make a turn or anything, so Alder kept on pushing. As the tunnel started to grow brighter, I looked ahead and saw a small spot of light way in the distance. Before I could ask what it was, Alder said,
"The tunnel leads to the sea. The end is not far from here. You cannot enter from the outside because the opening is high in the bluffs. It is to bring fresh air into the mines."
Fresh air, yeah, right. Not fresh enough to get rid of the poisonous gas that was killing all the miners. I then noticed something else weird. Throughout all the tunnels, the walls looked the same. They were made of solid, craggy rock that had been chiseled out by hand. But here, it was different. Along one side of the tunnel were round stone columns. They were wide, too, maybe 3 feet in diameter, and looked to me like big ancient columns from Greek ruins.
"The miners uncovered these by accident many years ago," Alder said. "They are the foundation of the Bedouin palace."
Whoa! That meant we were directly under the fortress.
"The Bedouin do not know that the Malago have tunneled under their palace,"
Alder added.
"If they did, they would have closed this tunnel off and killed some miners in punishment."
There must have been about 20 of these pillars, and they were roughly 10 yards apart. I saw off to the side, between two of the stone pillars, another tunnel. Actually, it was more like a small recess, because just inside it was a ladder. Obviously, this ladder led up into the palace. Gulp.
"No one knows why this secret entrance was created," said Alder as we climbed out of the ore car. "It is older than any of the miners who are alive today."
I stood at the bottom of the ladder and looked up. I then looked back at the others. It was showtime.
"Let's make sure we're all on the same page," I said. "Our plan is to get to the cell where they're keeping Uncle Press as quietly as possible. If this becomes a fight, we'll lose."
I said this while looking straight at Lore. She looked away from me. I knew she agreed, but it was killing her.
"Alder," I said, "can you get us to the cell area?"
"Yes, I think so,"
was his answer.
"You think or you know?"
I didn't want anything left to chance.
"I know,"
came his more confident reply.
"Good,"
I said.
"But it is not going to be as easy to get back unnoticed,"
he added.
"And that is when we fight," said Lore.
"Yeah, whatever," I said, and turned for the ladder. Jeez, she had a one-track mind. It wasn't until I got halfway up the ladder that I realized I didn't want to be the first one up. What was I thinking? I had no idea what might be waiting for me on top. But it was too late now. We weren't about to change places while dangling in the air. So I continued to climb and ended up on a dark shelf of stone. The ceiling was also stone, and it was so low that I couldn't stand up straight. The others quickly joined me.
"Now what?" I asked.
Alder knew exactly where to go. He walked a few feet along the stone ledge and then raised his hands. I looked to see that above him was a wooden door.
Huh. A trap door.
Alder pushed it up easily, then hoisted himself through it. Lore was next. She easily pulled herself up. It wasn't as easy for me. Not only was I shorter, but I had the pack on. I stood below the open trap door, looking up, and said,
Excuse me? A little help, please?
Lore and Alder both reached down, grabbed my outstretched hands, and hoisted me up as easily as if I were a child. We were now in another dark room.
"This leads to a storage room off the kitchen,"
Alder whispered. I figured that since he was whispering, we were getting close to where we might come across some Bedouin. Alder led us across the small room and then felt along one of the walls. I wasn't sure what he was looking for until he found it. There was a small notch carved into the stone. Alder stuck his fingers in and pulled. Suddenly, the wall opened up as if it were a door. We quickly went through, and Alder closed the secret door behind us. When I looked back, I saw that once it was closed, you could barely see the seam where the door was. The wall was smooth, as if it were made out of plaster. That seemed weird. Everything I had seen so far on Denderon was crude and rough. This wall seemed almost modern. I looked around to see that we were in a storage room. There were baskets of food and rough burlap bags full of stuff. There were also stacks and stacks of earthen pots. I was hit with a bunch of new smells. For the last several hours, I had been smelling that nasty, sweet smell in the mines. But now I got the definite aroma of cooking food. I had no idea what it was, but it was making my mouth water. All I could think of was how my house smelled at Thanksgiving. My stomach rumbled. So did Lore's, I'm glad to say. On the far wall was a wooden door. Alder crept quietly to it and gently eased it open. Instantly, the sounds of banging pots and sizzling food filled the room like a busy restaurant kitchen. Again, my stomach rumbled. I wanted to get out of here as soon as possible because this was torture. Alder waved for us to come and look. Lore and I joined him at the door and peered out. What I saw gave me a total shock. This was a busy kitchen. Several cooks scurried around carrying large, succulent roast turkeys cooked to a golden brown. Other cooks were peeling vegetables and cutting potatoes on large wooden tables. Others were stirring pots of fragrant soups that bubbled on fiery stoves. But that wasn't the shocking thing. What surprised me was how modern this kitchen was. Believe me, by our standards, it was still pretty ancient-looking, but not compared to what I'd seen so far on Denderon. The pots were crudely shaped and hammered out of black metal. The ovens were made of stone with fires burning inside. The chefs slid the turkeys and other roasts in and out of these ovens with long paddles. Their other utensils didn't exactly look as if they came from the mall. They were crudely made and very simple, but still, this setup was light years ahead of anything the Milago had. I saw a device that looked like a dumbwaiter. The chefs placed platters of sumptuous steaming food into a hole in the wall, then pulled on a rope that raised the small elevator and its cargo up into the palace. They even had running water. I saw iron sinks with hand pumps that produced clean, fresh water. Unbelievable! The Bedouin had running water, while the Milago had disgusting sewer holes in their crude huts. It was then that I noticed the kitchen workers. As they went busily about their chores, they had a different look than anyone else I had seen on Denderon. Their features were all very small and delicate, like perfect dolls. Everything about them was small, their hands, their feet, and even their height. Their eyes were different, too. They slanted down, which gave them kind of an Asian feel. They all wore outfits like we had on, but theirs were white. But the thing that jumped out the most about them was their skin. It, too, was pure white. I don't mean pale-skinned, like the Milago. I mean white. Believe it or not, it wasn't creepy. In some strange way, they were beautiful people. They just happened to look like porcelain dolls. Alder must have been reading my mind because he whispered,
"The workers in the palace are not Bedouin. They are brought from a place across the ocean called Nova."
"Why don't they use the Milago to do their work?" I asked. "They make them do everything else."
"Because they do not want the Milago to see how well they live,"
answered Alder, with a trace of venom.
They are afraid it would cause unrest.
That was an understatement. If I were a Malago and saw this, I'd be downright pissed. Heck, I was getting pissed anyway. And hungry. Those turkeys smelled good.
Look, said Lore, as she pointed across the kitchen.
Standing in the doorway was a guy who was definitely not from Nova. He was so big that he filled the opening. He wore the same kind of clothes we had on and stood with his hands on his hips, surveying the kitchen. Around his waist was a leather belt from which dangled a nasty-looking club. I could feel Alder tense up.
"It is a Bedouin knight,"
he whispered.
"I do not like this. The knights never come to the kitchens. He must be looking for something."
"You think they know we're here?"
I asked nervously.
"I do not know,"
answered Alder.
"But if he catches us, we are finished before we even begin."
The knight stepped into the kitchen and slowly walked around to survey things. The Novans paid no attention to him, and he didn't acknowledge them either. His eye slowly scanned the room, taking everything in.
We were trapped.
In a few moments, he would certainly enter this closet and find us. Alder said nervously,
"We should go back to the mines. We can wait until he's gone and then return."
"There isn't time,"
snapped Lore.
"When he enters the door, we will overpower him and throw him into the mine."
That wasn't a good idea either. We weren't about to kill the guy. At least I wasn't about to. And he'd be sure to wake up and sound some kind of alarm. And who knew what the Novans would do if a knight entered their pantry and never came out? No, beating up on the guy wasn't the answer. I quickly pulled off my pack and dug into one of the side pouches, looking for a better solution.
"What are you doing?"
demanded Lore.
"I've got an idea," I answered. "If it doesn't work, we'll do it your way."
I found what I was looking for and quickly moved back to the door. The knight was only a few yards away. There wasn't much time. He looked into a large pot of soup and reached in to take a taste. The slob. That's when I took my shot. The thing I pulled out was the laser pointer you sent. I clicked it on and aimed the red beam at the pot of soup. From where we were, it was easy to see the red laser dot against the black pot. I could only hope that the knight saw it too. He pulled his hand out of the pot and started to suck on his finger to taste the soup, but still he didn't see the laser. Alder and Lore watched the scene over my shoulder. Of course, they had no idea what this laser thing was, but now wasn't the time to ask. I jiggled the beam a little so that the red dot danced on the pot. The knight stood there sucking on his tasty finger. He was just about to reach back into the pot for a double dip when he saw it. He looked at the jumping dot curiously, without even taking his finger out of his mouth. The idiot. Then I slowly moved the dot off of the pot and let it travel across the stove. The knight, with his finger still in his mouth, followed it. This was like the game I play with Marley in a flashlight. I'd shine the beam on the floor and Marley would jump at it. The poor dog never got the idea that the spot of light wasn't something she could get her paws on. But that didn't stop her from trying. That's exactly what happened with the knight. I slowly moved the red laser dot over loaves of bread, past bubbling pots, across wooden tables, down along the floor, and back up on the wall. The curious knight never took his eye off of it. He followed the magical red light like, well, like a dog following a flashlight beam. What he didn't realize is that I was moving him farther and farther away from us. Once his back was to us, I silently motioned to the others to get moving. They slowly but silently opened the pantry door and crept out into the kitchen. I was right on their tails, while still concentrating on holding the beam steady to keep the dumbfounded knight entertained. We quickly moved across the kitchen to the exit. The Novans didn't even give us a second look. I was the last one out. My body was already out of the door, but I leaned back in, directing the beam. Then I turned the laser off and couldn't resist waiting one last second to see the befuddled knight's reaction. It was perfect. He stood still for a moment, then started looking around frantically. Sheesh, even Marley wasn't stupid enough to do that. I wanted to laugh out loud, but I couldn't stay to enjoy the show. We had to get moving, so I followed the other two into the palace. We had made it! We were in! The next step was to make our way to the cell where Uncle Press was being kept. Alder was already checking the map. All Lore and I could do was follow him and try to blend in. As it turned out, it wasn't all that difficult. The palace was busy with Bedouin people who all more or less looked and dressed like us. Yes, Lore's skin was a bit darker than most, but not so much that she stood out. If no one recognized us for who we really were, we might just make it. As we made our way through the corridors, what I saw was not only surprising, it made an anger grow inside of me that I never thought possible. The fortress was nothing like I expected. From the outside, it looked like an ancient stone castle like they had in medieval times. I had seen pictures of those castles that still stood in England, and the interiors were just as crudely simple as the exteriors. Here I expected to see corridors of stone and tiny cell-like rooms. I expected the floors to be of dirt and the light to come from windows or torches. You know, your basic Robin Hood-style castle. But this is not at all what we found inside the Bedouin fortress. The kitchen had been my first hint that all was not going to be what I thought. I'm telling you, Mark and Courtney, this place was beautiful. The walls were smooth and painted with light colors. Near the ceilings were elaborate decorative paintings done right on the walls. Some corridors had paintings of vines and flowers that stretched the whole length of the wall. Other corridors had paintings of people who were probably famous Bedouins from the past. The ceilings were decorated with colorful chips of glass that were sculpted into beautiful patterns. The floors were all tiled with intricate marble work, and the place was totally clean. Every so often, we'd pass one of the Novan servants on his hands and knees, scrubbing the floors or dusting the statues that stood on tables like this was some kind of museum. Lore and I exchanged glances. We were both thinking the same thing. How could these people live in such elegance at the expense of the Milago people? I saw that Lore's jaw was clenching. She was angry, too. We heard music coming from a room we were about to pass. As we went by, I glanced in to see a small concert going on. Three musicians sat on chairs playing oddball instruments like I had never seen before. They were string instruments, but they were shaped like human forms. It was really bizarro. The music they played was sweet and soothing. Several Bedouins lounged around listening on big, cushy pillows. Pillows! These people had pillows! And to top it all off, they had Novan servants scrambling around, serving them fruit from large platters. The more of the Bedouin people I saw, the more I realized that they were a pretty soft bunch. Except for the knights, of course. All the others had this kind of baby fat thing going on. The men, the women, even the kids, all looked as if they needed to hit the gym. I guess that's what happens when you have nothing to do except lie around, eat stuff, and listen to lame music. And here is the wildest thing. In every corridor along the walls, there were thin glass tubes about the diameter of a nickel. These tubes stretched the whole length of every corridor, and they gave off light. Light! They didn't have electricity here, but they figured out some way to make artificial light. The bottom line is that these guys were incredibly advanced. By our standards, they were still back in the Dark Ages, but compared to the Milago, they were the Jetsons. I was amazed at first, but my amazement was replaced by anger. The Milago were dying and living in squalor so that these people could get fat and live in such luxury. It was just flat wrong. The more I saw of how these people lived, the more determined I grew to get Uncle Press out of there, so he could help the Milago even things out a little. All the while I was taking in the rich surroundings, Alder had been leading us through the maze of corridors. The kitchen was on the lowest level of the palace. We had climbed one set of wide circular stairs to the next level. According to the map, this was the level where the prisoners were kept. Finally, we came to an area that was a little less fancy than the rest of the fortress. The walls didn't have paintings on them, and the floors and ceilings were bare.